Good evening, and welcome to our presentation of the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco tonight. We're very pleased to have as our guest an author, Lynn Downey, who is also a historian. And the subject of her very intensive historical research for the past, 25 years? Plus, probably a little more, has been the history of the individual Levi Strauss, and of course, collaterally, the history of Levi Strauss and Company, the iconic corporation that really is almost synonymous with the name San Francisco, and blue jeans and Levi's and all other kinds of trademarks that I have to be careful not to make generic. This evening is presented and underwritten for the Commonwealth Club by the California Historical Society and the Bernard Osher Foundation. So we owe them a vote of thanks for helping us out. Lynn is free, but my fee was so extraordinary that I had to go outside to cover their expenses. So Lynn, I think there's so much in this book, which I really hope people will buy and read. It's not just an incredible history of the individual and the company, but really shapes San Francisco in the latter half of the 19th century. It's always interesting, though, to talk to historians about the methodology by which they approached a task, because you had a specific challenge in putting this book together. So why don't you address that challenge and your methodology and how you did your research, and we can start there.
Yeah, well, I was hired as the first company historian for Levi Strauss & Co. in 1989, and you know that when you go to work for a company that was founded before 1906, you're not going to have any historical records to work with. That's a given. But what I didn't realize going in was that everything about the man, the founder, would also be gone. Levi Strauss was living with Jacob Stern and his family, his nephew's family, on Leavenworth between Post and Geary, and he died in 1902. That house went up in flames on April 18th, 1906. So there was nothing personal of the man, diaries and letters or anything like that. So I was the corporate historian, but the corporate historian for, you know, the eponymous company, Levi Strauss. And as I got to learn the company history and began to work in the archives, I also wanted to do research on the man himself. And because there was nothing to work with, that meant I got obsessed. And so whenever I could, around my, you know, my daily duties and my, as the years went on, and I was on staff for 24 years, I did what I could to find out about the man. And that meant going to libraries, going to different countries to track him down or just to have his experience. I went to Buttenheim, Germany. I went to the house where he was born, which is now a museum. I tracked his trip across the Isthmus of Panama. That's another story. But so as I was going on and going on and going on, and as I got closer to the time when I wanted to retire, and I wanted to retire specifically so that I could write this book, I almost had enough information, but it had taken all that time. But what really turned the dial for me was when historic newspapers became available online and completely searchable. And I paid for every service there was, and I used every free service there was, and I would spend weekends in my jammies in front of my computer looking up Levi Strauss, because he was so important to San Francisco. He was so prominent here in the city. His opinion was solicited by so many people. His name showed up in the papers all the time. So I was able to track him down. So it was libraries and other archives and newspapers everywhere that people would leave footprints in the historical record. And when I finally had enough information in my 130-page timeline, I was ready to write.
Wow. So let's start. I'm curious, actually, what ad showed up in the on the pages after searching Levi Strauss for 3 weeks in a row? You're probably just getting nothing but Levi Strauss ads.
Actually, no. Although they were hilarious, very entertaining. Yeah. But I would find, you know, Levi Strauss was in, you know, this term's grand jury. or Levi Strauss was on this committee to help raise money mm-hmm. to give unemployed men work in Golden Gate Park.
Yeah.
So it was his philanthropy, his philanthropic wow. activities, his work with UC Berkeley, his appearance on a variety of committees, uh-huh. Working with people. He was on committees with people like Leland Stanford, former Mayor James Phelan. You know, there all the big names of San Francisco would be in the same article as Levi Strauss. It was fascinating.
Let's scroll back to the beginning. He was born where?
He was born in Buttenheim in Bavaria, although I must tell you that he was born, the Buttenheim is his village, is the Franconian region of Bavaria. And if you go to Buttenheim and you tell the people you know that they are really Franconian, they will buy you a beer. And the beer is really good in Buttenheim. Yeah. It's the Franconian region of Bavaria. Uh-huh. He was born February 26, 1829. He was born Loeb Strauss. He was the youngest son of Hirsch Strauss, who had five children by his first wife, and then Levi had one older sister, Fugele. His wife's name was Rebecca Haas, no relation to the Haas family of San Francisco that we know and love. They were from Reckendorf, the village about an hour and a half away. And so he grew up in his village. He went to school. He went to synagogue. But the entire family was living under this terrible thing in Bavaria called the Juden Edict. In 1813, the Bavarian government had created this law to try to make real German citizens out of its Jews, but at the same time not really give them any more rights. At the same time, it was a very bizarre thing. And so under the Juden Edict, everybody in Bavaria had to live under this law. They had to take German names, men could not engage in their traditional occupations such as peddling, which was Levi Loeb's father's trade, or cattle trading. His two grandfathers were cattle traders. And so they had to take on things like becoming farmers, or they had to be shoemakers or other small craftsmen. And then every village had to have something in it called a register called a matrikel. And every Jew in a village had to be on this matrikel. Only the oldest son in a village, and their name would be right there, was allowed to marry. And a man could not marry off the register unless he married a widow, unless a childless couple gave up space for him, or he went to another village. So what does this mean? This means that all the younger sons in a family can't get married.
Yeah.
This means there are fewer men for the daughters of the family to find husbands. So it was a terrible way to live.
Mm-hmm.
And they were allowed to practice their religion. They could hire their own teachers for their schools. They could hire their own rabbis. But they were under this heavy hand on their head all the time. So in 1837, 18 young people just left Buttenheim. They said, we've had enough. We can't have a life here. And two of them were Levi's siblings. His oldest brother, Jacob, who could have stayed in Buttenheim and married, but he decided to go to London and be a tailor. And his oldest sister, Rosla, who moved to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
3 years later, the other two brothers left, and they went to New York City as well. Jonathan, who became Jonas when he arrived in New York and applied to be an American citizen, and Lippmann, who became Lewis when he arrived in New York. So everybody's gone. You know, so many people are gone. Four of his siblings are out of the house. And then the really unthinkable happens. Levi's father dies in 1846. So his mother is a widow, and she has to make this decision about how she's going to take care of her family. She had helped raise the youngest child, the youngest daughter. Her name was Myla. Plus, she had her own two children. And she said, I know it's time for me to go. It's time for me to go to America. And she made that decision because there was nothing, there was nobody in the village of Buttenheim to support her. And they were getting, I'm very sure, getting these glowing letters back from Jacob and Lewis. It's great here. You know, we're doing wonderful. Yeah, they were in the dry goods business in New York City.
Yeah.
Come, please come and be with us. Come and live with us. So she made this decision. But if you wanted to leave Bavaria, if you were a Jew and wanted to leave Bavaria and go to another country, you just couldn't pack up and go. You had to do a number of things. You had to apply to the government for permission to leave Bavaria. You had to publish a notice in the local paper announcing your intention to leave so that if you owed anybody money, they would know you were leaving and they could track you down. You had to leave money behind for the poor box so that if you didn't make it in the New World or any other country and had to come back, you wouldn't come back and be a burden on the state.
Mm.
So you also had to file a statement with the government about why you wanted to leave. And these had to be very carefully worded statements, because you couldn't say, I'm leaving, there's nothing for me here, I hate it, you know, even though you felt that way.
Yeah.
But you also had to show that you were leaving because you were looking for opportunity and you didn't want to be a burden to the state. And I'd actually like to read the statement that Levi's mother and Levi himself had to file to leave Bavaria. And I have to give a shout out to Dr. Tanja Ruppelt, who is the director of the Levi Strauss Museum in Bottenheim, who found these documents in the Bavarian State Archives.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Historians also need allies, especially in other countries.
Yeah.
So here's what Rebecca said. After the death of my husband, I lost the support of my maintenance. My older sons, who could come to my aid, have emigrated. Thus, I am in embarrassment as to how I may progress or support my son, Loeb, who has not learned the business of trade and has no desire to learn it. Typical teenager.
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah, exactly. My sons, who are located in America, have landed on their feet, for according to their letters, they are successfully engaged in business. I have therefore decided to emigrate with my remaining children and to seek my goal in that other part of the world. My son Loeb is now at the point where he can support himself and, if necessary, support me. So what is she saying? She's saying, I don't want to be a burden here. I need somebody to support me. I'm going to leave, and then you don't have to worry about me.
Right.
And this is what Levi said. The favorable news that I have received from my stepbrothers in America has convinced me to follow them, even though I do not have at this time a specific occupation. But my brothers will take care of that. No members of my family will stay behind. I will share the fate that has been assigned to me with them in foreign lands. I thus join my mother in her plea.
That shows a canniness on his part.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And some coaching, most likely, from people who knew how to write this.
Yeah.
He also had to either do his military service or have someone pay to have it done. And Tanya, the director of the museum, is pretty sure that Rebecca's brother, Isaac, paid for his military service so Levi could leave the country.
So he, moving through this, so he gets to New York and settles in with his family. But how does he get to San Francisco from there?
Well, he settles in with his family, begins to learn English, and like his brothers, applies to be an American citizen, and then begins to learn the dry goods trade. His brothers are urban peddlers. They may have also had a small storefront, but any business records from the family in New York are just gone, and they're really gone. So he learned about dry goods, clothing, blankets, pillows, you know, the kind of soft goods for daily living. And he learned that business in New York City as he's learning the language. Then the gold rush happens. And a lot of men leave New York and go to California, and they either set up as wholesalers in San Francisco and importing goods and then selling them to the small stores of the West, or they become the store owners themselves in places like Auburn and Sutter Creek and all those little gold rush towns. They're sending letters back to everybody in New York. So at some point, the Strauss family was probably sitting around the dinner table saying, you know, one of us needs to go to California. One of us needs to go to San Francisco and set up the West Coast branch of the business. So, Loeb, you're the youngest. You're unmarried. Guess what you get to do?
Yeah.
Except that I don't know if, I wish I knew, did he jump or was he pushed? You know?
Yeah.
I just wish I knew how that conversation went.
Yeah. How old was he at this
He
point?
Was 23 years old. Uh-huh. And by the way, in 1850, or before, sometime before then, he had started calling himself Levi. He wasn't Loeb anymore. When the census taker came to the house in 1850, he wrote down Levi. And there are many reasons for that. First of all, Americans cannot say Loeb. That's not happening. but he wanted to become an American citizen. And he wanted to have a new name for his new life. Mm-hmm. Levi was appropriate for his own culture, and Americans knew the name from their reading of the Bible. So it was a name that he could take on, you know, with pride, and it would help him, you know, in his future life.
Uh-huh.
So sometime at the end of 1852, the brothers put huge barrels of dry goods on a clipper ship that went down around the tip of South America heading for San Francisco. On January 31st, 1853, Levi went into the New York court and forswore allegiance to the King of Bavaria, became an American citizen, and 5 days later he was on the boat for San Francisco.
Wow.
He had to wait for that citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And also in that interim, I'm sure that he was writing to people in in San Francisco, saying, I'm coming. Can you help me secure warehouse space? He decided to do the wholesale part of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure he also arrived in San Francisco with letters of introduction to these small retailers up in the Gold Rush country. And mm-hmm. it would say something like, let me introduce you to Levi Strauss. It would be a letter from someone in New York. He is starting a new business. Please give him your custom. And that's how he would find his retail customers. And then his brother sent him these ship holds full of the dry goods that came around the tip of South America.
That took quite a bit of creativity and initiative for a guy without, I assume he didn't have a huge amount of capital, except for his dry goods, and to establish himself. He must have been pretty acute at how to get all of this rolling.
That's very true, and I don't think his brothers would have entrusted him with this incredibly important task if they hadn't believed in his ability. And, you know, one of the other reasons I wrote this book is there was so much mythology about the man. We'll be here all night if I talk about all the myths about Levi and the beginning of blue jeans. But one of them was sort of this image that this penniless, immigrant, stumbles off. Before I forget, by the way, today is the 164th anniversary of the day Levi arrived in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
That's great. Yeah.
So he's not stumbling off the steamer from Panama with nothing. He has a warehouse space already set up. He knows he's got these bulk loads of dry goods coming, on his way. And he has these letters to help him set up his business. So mm-hmm. he's basically grubstaked by his brothers back in New York.
Yeah.
But he had spent all those years. It was sometime around the summer of 1848 he arrived in New York. He had 5 years to learn this business and to learn English. To get enough, gain enough as a businessman himself to basically be the West Coast branch of J. Strauss Brother & Co., J. being Jonas Strauss, the patriarch of the family.
What was San Francisco like when he arrived here? I mean, culturally and physically.
Levi had missed the early wacko days of the Gold Rush in San Francisco when it was, this town was nothing but a bunch of canvas tents. And, it had been burned down a few times. It was an established city. It had everything. It had banks. It had bakeries. It had lawyers. It had everything.
Yeah.
It really was becoming the commercial center, and already was really the commercial center of the Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. So it was an established city. But more importantly for him, there was an established Jewish culture here in San Francisco for him to just plug himself into, because he was here in San Francisco for 3 years before family members started coming out from New York to join him. So here he is, a young man, all alone. His warehouse is just a few blocks from the Barbary Coast. What is he going to do with himself? He joins Temple Emmanuel.
Yeah.
There are a number of, benevolent societies. He goes to benefits for these benevolent societies. Things like Eureka Benevolent Society, First Hebrew Benevolent Society, were set up to help new immigrants with funding. If immigrants come, let's say a family comes here and the man dies, leaves a widow and children, these societies will help and give money, to these families, help them, keep them on their feet. And there were a number of benefits for these in San Francisco over the years, and one of them featured Lola Montez, who did her famous spider dance in 1853. I know Levi was right in the front row for that one, because I know he went. I know he went to that.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Heck yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So what does he have? He has a place that's already a bit an established city.
Yeah.
It's becoming a cosmopolitan city, and he has everything, every bit of infrastructure that he needs to make himself a success, which at the same time means his family's going to be a success.
Yeah. So let's introduce Jacob Davis into the story.
So Levi has become a dry goods wholesaler. His sister Fanny and her family now live in San Francisco. He'd called the business Levi Strauss when he first arrived, but by the 1860s, he was calling it Levi Strauss & Co. because other family members had joined in. So it's 1872. He's this prosperous dry goods merchant. He's sought out for his political opinion. He thinks that's all he's going to do for the rest of his life. Then he gets this letter from a man named Jacob Davis. Now, Jacob Davis was born Jacob Ufes in Riga, which at the time was Russia, but is now Latvia. He was trained as a tailor in his home country, came to the United States when he was a teenager, worked on the East Coast as a tailor for a while, and then decided to try his luck out in the gold fields. Didn't do very well. But he sort of migrated all over San Francisco and Northern California and tried a lot of things. He was a tailor. He tried running a brewery. He was a storekeeper. When things didn't go right, he would just fall back on tailoring. But eventually, he and his family, and he changed his name to Davis sometime in the 1860s, they wound up in Canada, and then they wound up in Virginia City and then Reno in the late 1860s, literally days after Reno was established as a town in 1868. And he set himself up as a tailor again and occasionally tried to run a brewery. And he was kind of a frustrated inventor, although he actually had a patent on a clothes press. So he was like a tinkerer. So one day in late 1870 or early 1871, this woman comes into a shop and says, "My husband needs a new pair of pants. His pants are in such bad shape, he can't even leave the house. So I have come to ask you to make a pair of pants for my husband." So he says, "Take this piece of string and measure his waist and come back." So she does. So she's talking to the woman, and he's going to make the pants out of a fabric called duck, cotton duck, which looks a lot like canvas, but it's a really sturdy sort of off-white fabric. And she says, "Can you please do something to make these pants stronger?" He just goes through these like they're nothing. So one of the things that Jacob was making in his tailoring shop was horse blankets. And he had a horse blanket in progress on a table near him, and he used metal rivets to attach like the leather pieces of these horse blankets and make them stronger. And he thought, I wonder if I put rivets in these pants, if that would make them stronger. So he tried that, and he put them in the corners of the pockets, maybe at the base of the button fly. Oh dear, that's another story. And gives them to the woman. She takes them. He sees the guy wandering around town in Reno wearing his pants, and word gets around. People really like these pants. They last a long time. And so he starts cranking out these pants, and he realizes he has this amazing idea. What he wants to do is mass manufacture and mass market this product. But he can't even afford the patent papers. He certainly can't manufacture, so he needs a business partner. He bought his fabric. He was a wholesale customer of Levi Strauss & Co. He bought his fabric from Levi Strauss & Co. Everybody, even in Reno, knew Levi Strauss's name. So what does he do? He puts a collection of pants in a package, sends them via Wells Fargo Express to San Francisco, and then with a letter to follow saying, "Take a look at these pants. I've made this new style of product, and we need to patent these and mass market them, and if we work on this together, we can make a lot of money." There was no non-disclosure agreement in this package. He just hands off this million-dollar idea to Levi Strauss.
Yeah.
And you know why? He knew that he was sending these to an honorable man who would either say, "Yes, that's a great idea," or no, thank you. I would never take that idea from him.
Yeah.
So this is one of the reasons I wanted to write about Levi, because he's such an interesting, complicated, and visionary man. So here he is. He's never made a pair of pants in his life. He's a wholesaler. He brings in the goods from other places. He doesn't have a factory. He doesn't know the first thing about manufacturing. Does he say to Jacob Davis, "It's a great idea, but I'm just not equipped to do that right now"? On a document that is in the National Archives in Philadelphia, there is his handwritten note: "Call the lawyers," or something to that effect. "Sign him up," literally within days of getting this letter in July of 1872. And within days, the men had made their agreement, but it took almost a year for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to decide that it was an invention and something new, and before they finally issued the patent, which was on May 20th, 1873.
Mm-hmm.
So then, this is another great part of the story. Levi doesn't know how to make pants. He knows he doesn't know. So he has Jacob Davis move to San Francisco And to help him do that, he buys Jacob Davis's tailoring shop from him. That's in Reno. Jacob has the money to move to San Francisco. He's in charge of the manufacturing. And then Levi stays in charge of the dry goods because that's what he knows. Then a few years later, he sells the building back to Jacob Davis for a dollar. And Jacob gets to sell it again to make a little extra money.
That was nice.
Yeah. So that's how Jacob, you know, came into the business. He was the inventor. He came up with the idea.
He brought himself into the business.
Yes, he did. And he was, and that's because he had that inventor's mind.
Yeah.
You know. And then Levi had the vision to say, I don't know how to do this, but I know this is a good idea. I will surround myself with people, especially this one man, who knows what to do about this. And the two of them built that business together.
So how did he get the labor to... Because that's a fairly labor-intensive process at this point.
He put an ad in the paper. He put an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle, for example, asking for women to come to this office on Market Street for heavy working on heavy to do heavy work and to bring their own sewing machines with them. You know, I had this awful vision of these poor little ladies in their long dresses dragging, you know, sewing machines up Market Street. But they were actually pretty small, little portable machines. And, of course, women did home sewing all the time. The denim, I mean, they warned them, you know, this is heavy work. The denim in the 19th century is pretty, you know, tough stuff. But it said, you know, steady and remunerative work. So it was so easy for them to get sewing machine operators. The company leased space for a while and then got their own manufacturing facility on Fremont around the corner from Market Street in the 1880s.
So you said when Jacob Davis was up in Reno, he was using duck cloth, and now you've given us the term denim. So why don't we get into the taxonomy of fabric?
Well, the origin of the cloth itself and the origin of the name is one of those topics that, you know, textile historians will, you know, arm wrestle each other about because there's you know, not everybody always agrees on this, but here's sort of the basic story. Denim, as we know it today, actually originated in like 17th century France, and it was actually a wool and silk blend. And it was a serge weave of fabric made in the town of Nîmes. So the fabric was called serge de Nîmes. So then English textile manufacturers started to make the same fabric. For a while, they called it serge de Nîmes because it's good marketing to give something a zippy French name. But over the decades, it became an all-cotton fabric, and then the name was anglicized to denim. So then denim crossed the pond in the 18th century. George Washington actually toured a Massachusetts textile mill in 1789 and watched denim being made. So American denim has been made in America since the 18th century. And here's one of the myths that makes me nuts, is that there are still people in Nîmes, France today who will tell you that Levi Strauss used French denim for those first jeans. And I wish they'd shut up about it, because it's not true. It is not true. So it was one of the traditional fabrics for workwear, for men's workwear, and that's what these pants were.
So what is denim? As opposed to other fabric?
It's a twill weave, and the weave, it's two threads. One is a colored thread and one is a white thread. And it's that white thread that comes through, you know, when we wear our jeans, you know, for a long time. And denim can actually be made in any color. The company made pants out of something called a blue and gold denim. That fill yarn was gold on top of, you know, indigo blue. Excuse me, underneath indigo blue. So denim is a specific weave. It's all cotton. And by the time that Levi was making these first pants, they were dyed with indigo, which had been synthesized in the United States and was being manufactured in the United States, had been for over 100 years. But they also used cotton duck, which is that sturdy, heavy, canvassy-like fabric. And the word is from a Dutch word meaning flax or linen, which is it can look like as well. So the company made denim and duck pants in the same traditional style. And what Jacob was doing was making basic pants. What was new about them was the rivets. So they made them out of duck and denim. Denim sort of overtook duck in terms of sales because, you know, we all wear denim. It gets all nice and soft and wonderful, you know, after you wear it for a while. But no matter how much you wash that duck, you always feel like you're wearing a tent.
Yeah.
And that's not comfy.
Yeah.
So denim, you know, slowly but surely overtook. And again, the men were used to wearing denim pants. they'd never had rivets in these denim pants before. But Jacob made pants that men were used to wearing. So they weren't so new that they were bizarre, you know, when men found them on the shelves. It was the rivets that made them that new thing. It was that new category of workwear that today is the blue jean.
Yeah. So eventually we identify now a pair of Levi's with the arcuate on the pocket and the orange stitching and the leather patch. So let's start with the leather patch, the history of how that evolved.
The patch was on the jeans from the very beginning. And at first, it just had the company name, Levi Strauss & Co., and printing that said patent riveted clothing, because they had to say this over and over and over. Right. You know, this was a patent. And the company knew that patent would run out in 1892. Mm-hmm. So patent riveted clothing, and then just a simple, you know, waist and length, which often was handwritten in black ink on the patch. So as the company got closer to that patent running out, because when you have a patent, it's considered technology, and you can only benefit it for a certain period of time, and then it has to go into the public domain. So they knew that after they extended the patent for a couple of years, that was going to run out in 1892. So in the 1880s, the company started to do what today we would call branding.
Right.
And in 1886, came up with the famous two-horse, you know, tug-of-war, the two-horse pull, and began to put that on the leather patch, sort of stamped on or embossed on. In 1890, when they made other pairs of pants that had a linen patch, that was printed in linen. The two-horse design went on invoices, went on letterhead, went on documents and the pants. Mm-hmm. It was you know, reinforcing this idea and this image. And I think there was another reason for that. Somebody in the company understood that not everybody in the American West spoke English as their first language, and not everybody was literate. So many people navigated society through symbols. Mm. The barber pole, you know, the three balls for a pawn shop. Mm-hmm. So after 1892, when anybody who wanted to could start making riveted clothing, they could go in a store and see a whole bunch of riveted pants, but they could walk in and they could say, I want the one with the two horses on it. And in fact, the company called that the two-horse, called the product the two-horse brand until 1927, when Levi's was becoming a generic and the company registered the name as a trademark.
You mean the term Levi's?
The term Levi's. Yeah. Everybody was calling everything denim Levi's. And so in 1927, it became a registered trademark. Mm-hmm. So that was the patch. And that was one of the first sort of branding exercises that the company engaged in.
That was pretty important. To preserve that identity.
It was very important, and again, a way for customers to quickly identify the product. And when all these other companies like Stronghold and Can't Bust 'Em, Boss of the Road, all these other brands, they all had leather patches on them.
Yeah.
Hello. They had rivets in their pants, and they had, you know, patches on them, just like Levi Strauss did.
Yeah. So let's go back to Levi Strauss. He developed this very successful business. Let's take the latter part of his life. What did he find to be his satisfaction and his reward as he grew older in San Francisco?
Luckily for us, a lot of reporters asked him that very question. And at the end of his life, he gave more than one interview in which he said that his life had been his business. He never married, and he lived with his sister or her children from the time he was in his early 40s until the day he died. And I really believe what he said, that his life had been his business. Early on, he was the representative of that family business, and then he became the patriarch of the business. So he was very satisfied with that, but there was this other part of him, and that was the philanthropic part of his life. He had always given to the less fortunate. Less than a year after he arrived, sometime in 1854, he gave $5 to the Orphan Asylum Society of the City of San Francisco, which is still in business today. It's the Edgewood Center for Children and Families out in the Sunset. And from then on, he gave money personally. His company donated to disaster relief, to the poor, to whatever. And those kind of donations show up in the papers, I was able to track where his philanthropy went and where it was the strongest. And that is one way that I was able to get a little more insight into his personality. Yeah. He threw a lot of his money at children. From the time it was founded in 1876, he was a vice president of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children here in San Francisco until the day he died. So the welfare of the young, the welfare of children was huge for him. He gave a lot of money to orphanages, left a lot of money to orphanages in his will.
And how about the University of California?
And education, exactly. Yeah. That is the other big thing for him. That's the other part. And again, that's to me, that's just an outgrowth of his care for young people. So in 1896, Levi and a couple of other men in San Francisco heard that students at UC Berkeley could not use the library at night because there weren't any lights. So they paid to have the library lit at night so the students could work at night. Great, we have to do more studying. But they were very grateful. Then in 1897, he heard that the California State Legislature was giving scholarships for every assembly district in the state, and there were 35 assembly districts at the time. And Levi heard about this, and he wrote to the head of the Board of Regents, Jacob Reinstein, and said, I would like to duplicate these scholarships so that every assembly district can send two kids to Berkeley on a scholarship. So, of course, the Board of Regents was happy to accept that.
Yeah.
And they named it the Levi Strauss Scholarship. And that scholarship is still in place today at UC Berkeley. Yeah. I had the great honor of meeting a few of the Levi Strauss scholars a few years ago, and they were very thrilled. They came to the Levi's Plaza, and it was just a wonderful event.
Did the company take over the responsibility for
yes,
that?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure how the funding works, but it's still there. Go to the website. There's the Levi Strauss Scholarship right there.
Yeah.
And the first beneficiaries of the scholarship, half of whom were women, showed up to surprise Levi Strauss at his home in March of 1898. Now, I don't really think it was a surprise because he just happened to be entertaining Jacob Reinstein and Phoebe Apperson Hearst. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, I don't think they were his regular dinner guests.
They picked them at random.
Totally, yeah. Pulled them in off the street. Yeah. And so the students trooped in and they gave him a plaque to thank him for making it possible for them to go to college, which breaks my heart because that's one of the things that went up in flames. In 1906, yeah.
I have to do my duty here. Let me remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're delighted tonight to be have as our guest Lynn Downey, who has written a book on the history of Levi Strauss and Levi Strauss and Company, and we're enjoying our conversation tremendously. So he was, by 1900 or 19... in that area, 1900, he was quite well along in both wealth and years. Did his health hold up, or what eventually happened?
All indications are that he stayed in the saddle almost until the day he died. He did one other philanthropic thing, though, I want to tell you about very near the end of his life. In 1900, he heard that his home village of Buttenheim, the cemetery in the town, was falling apart. And the city fathers and the Jewish residents in Buttenheim wanted to restore the cemetery, clean up the tombstones and get rid of the weeds. But they didn't have all the money they need. And so Levi sent half the money that was necessary to clean up the cemetery. But think about this. He had left that village almost 50 years earlier. He'd never been back. Nobody in his family was there, but his father's grave was there. And so were the graves of his grandparents and his great-grandparents. So I'm sure, you know, giving that money to Buttenheim was probably one of the most personally profound donations of his whole life.
Yeah.
You know, and he may have known he was nearing the end of his life.
That's a great story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in September of 1902, he had dinner with the family and said he didn't really feel very well. There was a nurse in the home. He may have been feeling not so good for a while. Went to bed, told the nurse that, you know, he felt about as well as he could, you know, under the circumstances. Went to sleep and never woke up. Yeah. He was 72 years old in 1902. Almost 73, actually.
So before the earthquake, obviously, that's really important. Mm-hmm. Had he bought out his partner at that time?
From what we know, Jacob Davis sold his interest in the patent back to the company about 1906, so that had not happened during Levi's lifetime. Jacob Davis worked Jacob Davis died in 1908, so he may still have been working when Levi died. That has been a little bit, you know, harder to figure out. but he was still part of the company.
One question I have, George, if you're around, are we going to have audience question cards? Yeah. Have you collected any? Okay. Well, that's fine. Just, we have time, but it'd be nice to give you an opportunity to ask your questions as well. The question of dissent of a company, because it's, as I said in my opening, it's an iconic company and it's synonymous with name San Francisco. And so when he died, if he had no heirs, how did the ownership of the company descend?
The ownership stayed in the family. So Levi Strauss had four nephews and three nieces. And I do want to mention that in his will, he left $25,000 to each of his nieces, directly to them, not to their husbands to, you know, manage for them, directly to his nieces. Yeah. So he left the business to his four nephews, Jacob, Abraham, Sigmund, and Louis Stern. Hmm. You've all heard of Sigmund Stern, right? Sigmund Stern, yeah. Grove. That was Levi's nephew. The business, the presidency of the business, Jacob Stern and Sigmund Stern were both presidents of the business. Abraham died young, very tragically. I believe it was some sort of foodborne illness. Hmm. And Louis actually lived out of San Francisco for many years. Sigmund Stern and his wife, Rosalie Meyer, had a daughter named Elise Stern. And she married a man named Walter Haas. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's Mr. Walter Haas' descendants, the lovely Haas family, who own the company today. Mm-hmm. So it is still that family business. It's a family tree that, you know, kind of goes like this. But it's still the family.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, I love the part about, you know, surprising people about Sigmund Stern, because so many people, of course, know that name and everybody's been to Sigmund Stern Grove.
It was Bob Haas who actually got you the project, right, to do this book?
Yeah, Bob Haas hired me in August of 1989. A number of the international managers in the company had gone to him about a year earlier and said, you know, the history of jeans and, you know, the Americana of this company really helps sell these blue jeans overseas. You know, it's such Americana. We know that there are some historical, you know, there's some stuff that managed to be, you know, collected after the earthquake and fire. You need to hire somebody trained in archives, trained in history, to sort of organize this material and make it systematically available to company management and to make it a part of the business, because our heritage is so much a part of who we are, and somebody needs to be in charge of that. And I was the lucky girl who got the job.
Yeah, great.
And Bob Haas was the archive's biggest fan his entire time I was there, I believe.
And you dragged it out for 25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well done. Yeah. So
believe me, when you go to library school, you don't think you're going to end up on the Oprah Winfrey Show, okay? Yeah.
So here we go. You mentioned that you went across the Isthmus of Panama early, and this question would like you to elaborate on why you did that.
Because I'm nuts.
Yeah. Okay. What's the second reason?
Well, I'd found out that Levi's took the fastest way to get from New York to San Francisco in 1853. So I began to study how the Panama route went. And it was so fascinating to me. And I'm one of these historians who tends to go every place that somebody's been, because it to be able to be in that place and breathe that air and touch those, you know, things is so meaningful for me. So for my vacation in 2009, no, not the company, not my vacation, I hired a guide and I went to Panama. And I did pretty much everything Levi did. And so this is how the trip went. He took a steamship from New York to the Caribbean side of the isthmus. Then when Levi was going across, the railroad was only completed halfway across the isthmus. So he took a railroad halfway. Then he got in a boat and navigated the Chagres River to a place called Gorgona. And there he hired a mule from Wells Fargo. They're everywhere. He hired a mule. And the mule went the last 18 miles to Panama City. And then he took another steamship up to San Francisco. So I hired a guide who happened to be the son of Panama's most famous anthropologist. And he was amazing. And yeah. So the Panama Railroad was completed in 1855, and so it's now this sort of a touristy thing. So we took the Panama Railway all the way across, and then we went on a boat on the Chagres River. And then he took me to one of the old trailheads that has not been inundated by, you know, Lake Gatun. And there weren't any mules for me to rent, but I walked on it for a while. And then I had another adventure on Lake Gatun, which you can ask me later. So, what I experienced was the climate, the kind of foliage that he saw, the capuchin monkeys, the birds, everything that Levi would have seen. And I was thinking about this boy who'd already been on two ocean voyages before he was 23 years old. And then, you know, he's from New York City in Germany, and he's in the tropics. Mm-hmm. And it was the fastest way to get across, but not necessarily, you know, fewer dangers. There's alligators, there's yellow fever, there's bandits, you know, everything. Oh, I mean, they, you know, his family put him on the boat.
Yeah.
They might never hear from him again, yeah. You know. But I also got to go to the National Library of Panama. There were newspapers printed in English because it was the way for gold miners to go across to California and then laden with gold to go home, hence the bandits. And so they published these English language newspapers in Panama for all these gold miners to read, and that's where I found the schedule that Levi Strauss took to find the actual
boat. So they would actually ship, when Levi Strauss would make money and need to send it back to New York, he'd ship it across the isthmus?
Yes. In fact, the company lost a huge amount of gold on one shipment. He put $76,000 worth of gold, which is about $2 or $3 million today, on a steamship to Panama, went on the railroad, and then was put on the Central America, which left the Isthmus of Panama and went down in a hurricane off South Carolina in September of 1857 with all of this money. And that always went to Jonas in New York for him to put in the bank and buy more dry goods and, you know, send it back. So they lost all this money, but they were doing so well. You know, it was a bit of a hiccup, but it didn't, you know, destroy the business. Mm-hmm. Somebody found that wreck in the 1980s. In the early 1990s, one of them called me and said that they found this trunk with some brown pants in it. I was like, no, they're not Levi's. But, oh, by the way, where's our gold? You know, but finders keepers, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
But I knew that in one other instance they lost money in a shipwreck, but they were fully insured as well.
This is an interesting question because as my image of him going across the Isthmus of Panama, what was he wearing? The question is, did he ever wear jeans?
Levi Strauss never wore a pair of jeans in his life. And here's why. Denim was workwear. Riveted denim was really workwear. And Levi was what was called a capitalist. He was a prosperous, wealthy, professional businessman. Nobody in that class would have ever worn jeans. And in those days, you didn't wear jeans just to relax, you know, kick back in your house on the weekend. So that it was just completely wrong for him, you know, to wear those pants to preserve who he felt he was, you know, his place in San Francisco society.
Yeah.
So when he was on the Isthmus, hopefully he was wearing something light and cool. It was kind of hot and sticky. but in his life, I mean, all the pictures we have of him, he's wearing a black suit, you know, has a white shirt, you know, a silk tie. Some of the pictures, he has a top hat. You know, this is who he was.
That must have been hot in Panama.
Oh, it was, trust me.
This question, I'll summarize it, but it says you made an oblique reference to the rivet, how do I say it, delicately?
The crotch
at
rivet?
The bottom of,
yeah.
Yeah, that's delicate, yeah. and you said that's another story, so what is that story?
Everybody wants to know the story. All right. Yeah. So when the pants were first made, there were rivets on the corners of all the pockets. There was a belt on the back of the waistband. It was called a cinch, and you would cinch it in or let it out, you know, depending on, it was before the days of belt loops. And then these were points of strain, and one of those was at the base of the button fly, and there was a rivet there. So for years, the company had gotten letters from guys saying, you know, when I crouch in front of a campfire, this rivet heats up in a very delicate place. And it was mostly cowboys, so the company's thinking, what a bunch of wimpy cowboys. Yeah. Well, then it happened to Mr. Walter Haas when he was camping. Now, that happened about the time that World War II broke out. And all American clothing manufacturers during the war years had to take a certain amount of metal off of their clothing. So another imaginary conversation in my head, they're sitting around the table, which rivets are we going to get rid of? Well, yeah. What do you think? You know, the one at the base of the button fly is going. Yeah. And it never came back until the company started to make reproductions of historic jeans. And, of course, for authenticity, it's back.
It's back.
So be careful if you're crouching.
So don't go camping.
Don't go, no, don't, no.
So while we're on more of these trademark type things, the question is, where did the red tab originate?
So I told you that the patent ran out and a lot of other companies were making riveted clothing. All of these other companies made clothing in dark blue denim. They had a leather patch on the back of the waistband. They had rivets. They had the cinch. And so it was very difficult for company managers to do what they called informal market surveys, which was really just looking at butts at rodeos. And so from a distance, they couldn't really tell if this person was wearing a pair of Levi's jeans or not. So the national sales manager came up with the idea of putting this little ribbon of red on the, you know, the side of the right back pocket, put the word Levi's in white letters, in all capital letters, and then register it as a trademark. And that way it could show up, you know, from a distance, and as a trademark, nobody could copy it. Mm-hmm. And it made it easier later for a historian to watch old movies and figure out who was wearing Levi's in the old movies.
Yeah. And it's worth pointing out that as opposed to the patent, a trademark lasts forever. As long as you use it.
As long as you use it and keep re-registering it,
and
it is yours.
Don't genericize it. Yeah. So that red tab and the leather patch and the arcuate really had a lot of power beyond the life of the rivets.
And still do.
There's a question curious about the manufacturing. How many women did he actually employ, and do you have any sense of what the wage was?
Unfortunately, that's the kind of historical information that has been impossible to track down. There's a flyer from the 1880s that has this lovely drawing of a bunch of women at the sewing machines, and one of them has a flower in her hair. It's like, really? But it says, this facility employs over 500 girls, meaning women. So, you know, and that's the pre-1906 factory on Fremont Street. So it has to have been hundreds and hundreds. And even the post-1906 factory at 250 Valencia Street, the records just don't exist. We just really don't know.
There is one part of your book, I think, that several questions ask about, and I think this person must have read the book, and that is the reference to made by whites on the labels, mm-hmm. and the something that today we would never do. What's the background of that?
In the 1880s, even after the turn of the century, some of the company's marketing had the phrase made by white labor. Now, if you're going to discriminate against anybody in San Francisco, and traditionally in San Francisco, that discrimination has been against the Chinese, going all the way back to the 1870s. There was labor unrest because the Transcontinental Railroad had been completed, and Chinese men, as well as other men, were in San Francisco looking for jobs. And, you know, the Chinese were the other in 19th century San Francisco. This is one of the icky, ugly parts of the story. But that's the other thing about studying San Francisco history. You have to talk about this. This is the way business was done in the 19th century. The company knew, Levi knew, that if he didn't make it very clear that he did not hire Chinese in his factories, nobody would buy his pants. In fact, the company was actually accused in an 1876 newspaper article of implying, you know, hundreds of Chinese in their factories, and the response was, no, we don't. We have one man who cuts the denim because nobody else will do it. You know, that kind of stuff. It's the way it was in 19th century San Francisco. I don't know how Levi personally felt about the Chinese. We never will know unless we find some sort of, you know, diary shows up somewhere. But as a businessman, he knew that he had to put that on his marketing, and he had to make it very clear to his customers, who were the small retailers of the American West, who would tell their customers, oh, by the way, don't buy these. You know, they're made by the Chinese. No one you know, would come out all right. So it's an ugly part of the story, but it is part of the story and had to be told.
Yeah, and it's good to get it out there so we remember history. as an instruction for today.
Yes. Here's the other instructive piece, though, that I always like to say when I give talks about Levi Strauss. The blue jean, the most American of garments, was conceived and first made by two immigrants. Mm. So that's one of the, if you're going to take anything away from tonight, that's the one thing I want you to remember.
Well, you teased us at the beginning disabusing myths. That's one of your projects. So what was your favorite myth to disabuse?
Oh, dear. How do I find a favorite?
Or your least favorite.
The least favorite, yeah. Well, the one that drove me craziest the most was this was the old story. You know, Levi took a clipper ship and arrived in San Francisco in 1850. And he saw gold miners wandering around San Francisco with their pockets hanging down because they were full of all this ore. And he knew they needed sturdy pants. So he had a roll of tent canvas in his dry goods, you know, grub stake. And he made a pair of pants out of canvas. Later, he dyed them blue, or he bought the denim from France. and then some guy in Reno came up with the idea of rivets, and he put rivets in them later on. Wow, so the first pants were made of canvas. No, they weren't. And this has gotten us into big trouble because canvas and cannabis are the same botanical family, and there's this, so there's all these people. The first jeans were made of hemp, weren't they? No! oh, my God. So That was the worst. That was awful. Of course, my other favorite was literally in the 1990s, a writer for the London Sunday Times said the company had been founded by Claude Lévi-Strauss, the French anthropologist. So the problem is these myths arose because there were no records after 1906, and they started to percolate out of the company, out of the company's marketing department around the time of World War II because there was so much competition in the jeans business. The company needed its origin story. Mm-hmm. So a few pairs of these brown duck pants had been given to the company by people who found them over the years. And so somebody sort of made this, with no historical training at all, leap of conclusion. Wow, I'll bet the first pants were brown. And I'll bet he had those in his drawer. I mean, it was just, can you just imagine, the kind of conversation. So the impulse was correct. You know, we made the first jeans. We want an origin story to tie us to the gold rush, but they made it up. And it's, that's been, I've gotten almost an arm wrestling, matches myself with people who are sure that's the right story, because it's been around for 70 years.
Well, when people Google it now, they'll find your book.
No, don't. That's opposed why I wrote to this.
French anthropologist. who were his social friends? There were the Spreckles and the Leland Stanford and people like that at the time. Did he hang in those circles, or as they say?
The Spreckles, the Sugar family, Stanford, Phelan, all of these guys, they certainly were his commercial circle. I have no idea who his sort of personal social circle was. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that he spent a lot of time with his very extended family, and I have a feeling that's where his quality time went. But that's just a feeling. Yeah. Again, no diaries, nothing. There are only two letters that I know of where he's written, to someone. One of them is to one of his nieces, and it's at the Magnus Museum. That's now part of the Bancroft Library. Mm-hmm. And the other was a letter that he wrote to a storekeeper in Sonoma, thanking them for a gift that they had sent him, for the holidays. And it was a customer of his. And I only have that because the man who had it in the town of Sonoma, which is where I live, contacted me and said, I have this original Levi Strauss letter that was in my father-in-law's effects, because he inherited his father-in-law's law business, and he was from that grocery store family in Sonoma. And so I started throwing money at him. What do you want for it? And he didn't want any money for it. I said, well, what do you want? He said, I want a 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition gold coin. So I threw more money at him, and he's like, no. So I was actually giving a lecture to this wonderful group called the Westerners. This is a wonderful historical group. And I was at the dinner afterwards, and I happened to mention this to the person who was sitting next to me at the table. He's like, oh, I've got one of those coins. He was a dealer. He was a, like an Old West dealer. So I bought the coin from him. I went and I gave the coin to the lawyer and he gave me the letter. It was awesome. Uh-huh. It's one of the most fun acquisitions I ever made in the archives.
Yeah. You ought to go on eBay. So what if you were to now, based on obviously a lot of its inference and working with a blank slate in a sense, if you were to sit down and in a few minutes describe what you think Levi Strauss would be like if we were sitting here talking with him, what would be your conjecture?
I would quote someone that was interviewed in 1960. In 1960, someone at the company interviewed a number of people who'd worked for the company when Levi Strauss was still alive. And they talked to this one woman who'd been a sewing machine operator here in San Francisco when Levi was in charge of the business. They said, in charge of the business, and they said, "What was he like?" And she said, "He was tough, but a fine fellow."
Yeah. That's a very poignant, and I think, Lynn, it's a perfect place for me to thank you for this contribution you've made.
Thank you.
And Lynn will be out in the hallway signing books. And one person asked a question as to how she can research immigration from 1850 to 1852 from Germany. And I think I'll say to whoever you ask, talk to Lynn at the book signing.
Track me down.
Yeah, track her down. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, everyone.